This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rachel Neiman from the Corsham Institute.
I'm Rachel Neiman, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Corsham Institute. The Corsham Institute is a not-for-profit organisation that works for a fair, inclusive, creative and prosperous society based on trust and security.
We have a significant challenge in the UK in many sectors. Cybersecurity is one, which is the reason I'm here with you today. We have skills gaps that actually are not as big as people think, and that's because we have people who are not necessarily welcoming companies because of a perceived lack of education or a perceived socioeconomic background. How do we start to address that?
There is definitely a wide skills gap, and I would agree with you that there is a big pool that isn't being used at the moment to fill that skills gap. I'm not sure whether that pool already has the skills or whether that pool could simply be supported to gain skills that they already inherently are beginning to use in other ways. So I do completely agree that there is less acceptance that people from more excluded parts of society may be able to fill the skills gap that we so badly need as an economy.
Employers tend to look more for certification and educational qualifications when they're doing their first round of recruiting. What needs to change to bring these people A, into employment, but B, to be able to grow this skills base?
Many people in that type of situation who are not attracted to traditional forms of employment or who are not attracted to traditional forms of education will be difficult to reach and are difficult to reach. They do have the ability, they do have the skills and the capability, but they may not have the trust in either the educational authorities or the traditional employer-employee relationship to take that leap. So outreach to find where those people are is absolutely critical. And that needs to be done through community groups, that needs to be done at a very local level, at a very hyper-local level, in order to identify where people with those skills are.
When you're setting up those local groups, how do you identify the right people? How do you identify the right locations for those groups?
It's very challenging to uncover talent and to uncover people that can fill these gaps when they don't necessarily put themselves forward or want to be found. We need to rely on local organisations and groups that attract those people to come forward. So that could be local groups that focus on cybersecurity techniques. There are plenty of young people hacking away in their bedrooms. We need to be able to reach and access those. There are forums, there are chat rooms, there are ways of identifying these people, but they won't be the traditional ways that employers are used to doing. There's definite challenge in how you deliver that outreach that will gain the trust of those people, that will then engage them in what you're trying to do and engage them in becoming part of the workforce.
Obviously, that's something that most employers won't be in a position to do. So who should we be looking to start that level of initial outreach?
I think this is a job for intermediaries. I think this is for trusted intermediaries that, again, I'm going to repeat the word trust, that gains the confidence of the people that we are looking to attract. And I think in the conversation that you and I had before this podcast, we talked a lot about young people and about young people particularly who have computer skills and an ability to hack, and how valuable those skills can be for cybersecurity if those are turned into a positive as opposed to a negative. The police, the prevent people, organisations that are already tracking the activities of some of these young people online could actually be turned into a positive rather than a negative.
How do we then extend that trust to employers? Because employers have a duty of care to other workers, they have a duty of care to the business. There's always been one or two employers who've been very keen to help people rebuild their lives, recover from whatever misfortune hit them. But there's a lot of employers that just think of it as being too much trouble. How do we change that conversation?
We need to look at what the risk assessment really is. There are well-known organisations that make a point of recruiting and employing ex-offenders and giving people a second chance, and I think that's absolutely right and absolutely fantastic. I think the level of risk is probably a lot lower than people perceive. I think there are some bureaucratic and there are some organisational and structural constraints, but I think that's part of the culture of an organisation. And if an organisation's senior executives and board are able to see that they will get far more value from people who may not have had the same advantages or background as they do, I don't see that the risk is that great. It's making the right risk assessment, it's being able to identify and outreach to these people, and then demonstrating, with of course the right safeguards in place, nobody's expecting any genuine risks to be taken, but with the right safeguards in place and the right support, I don't see any reason why ex-offenders or young people who have been in trouble with the police should not be given a fair chance at employment.
Do you think this is as much a society challenge as it is an employment challenge?
Yes, I do. I think that there's quite a black and white attitude, and I think that in today's society it's disappointing to see that issues of social exclusion are still very much in evidence, and some would say getting worse. When we look at the skills that are needed today, particularly the technological skills, there is a very strong correlation between communities and individuals who are digitally excluded and those that are socially excluded and financially excluded. A lot of work has been done around the issue of digital exclusion and inclusion, and the Tech Partnership have created a heat map of digital exclusion, which really could be read as social exclusion as well. Many of the indicators correlate to social exclusion. So we can identify through publicly available data where some of those hotspots are, and by working with the local community groups within those areas, I don't think it's too challenging to identify a cohort that could then be supported to turn their instinctive skills and interests into something much more positive to contribute to society and the economy.
In terms of training and education, there's another interesting challenge here. We've seen over the last 25, 30 years almost the loss of all of those colleges of further education, those places where people who were not going to university would be put by employers who were trying to build apprenticeships or to bring people forwards. As such, employers aren't really sure what they can do if somebody doesn't meet what they're told is the minimum educational qualification for a job role. How do we get employers to take a gamble and say, well, okay, you might not have that level of maths or English, but actually you have other skills that would take us much longer to educate you on, so we'll take you on those skills and we will invest in you and grow you from there. Because when I look around, I'm not yet seeing employers being that brave.
There is a lot of education of employers still to be done, and I think given that money is tight, given the economic constraints that many organisations are going through, it is difficult for them to justify taking that kind of risk. There needs to be much more education around the value of some of those soft skills that are not formal qualifications. Over the past few years, there's been such a great focus on formal education and formal qualifications as the entry point to employment, rather than skill in its broadest sense. And in fact, what we've been talking about today in terms of how to upskill military veterans coming back into civilian life, armed, excuse the pun, with many of the soft skills that are required, initiative, problem solving, ability to think on their feet. These are soft skills that are absolutely essential in the technical world that we live in now, but those aren't necessarily things that are going to appear on somebody's educational qualifications.
But that's also a challenge, isn't it, for HR departments during the recruitment process. They stand there and they look for a hard skill, something that is written down, a piece of paper. But all these soft skills, which are the things that make people who they are, they're so hard to evaluate, to assess. What needs to change in how we do that initial assessment of a potential employee?
To filter applications and potential candidates, simply because you have to start somewhere. But I think a much more practical focused recruitment system is potentially more appropriate for the skill sets that we need today. Now, of course, that's more labour intensive, that will therefore be more expensive. But I think something that is very helpful is the introduction of apprenticeships, of degree apprenticeships. I think greater use of internships and work experience at all levels, not just something for young people, not just something for 17-year-olds, but something that people who are in their 30s and beginning to look at a different career could actually take advantage of, because that way you can really test those soft skills over time. Now, I know that this is a huge change and it is difficult to implement, but frankly, the world is changing so quickly around us that if we don't adapt the way we recruit, we don't encourage employers to understand what they really need, we will never be the global economy that we want to be.
That really got my attention there. You didn't just talk about 16, 17-year-olds. You say it has to apply to everybody. And earlier today, we were talking about veterans and how veterans can be reskilled and brought back in. When people lose a job, the hardest thing for them is to find a job in a different area. We would call it resettlement from a service perspective, but it's more than just resettlement. The processes that were there 30 years ago to provide courses for somebody when they were made unemployed so they could go find a new job really don't exist in many cases. So how do we widen the opportunities for people? How does an employer look at an employee and say, well, actually, I'm overstaffed in that area. Some of you have some other interesting skills. I'd like to use you to fill an underserviced part of my business. How does an employer recognise that, and how do they build a programme to be able to allow employees to grow?
Well, I would suggest that a good employer would know the skills of their employees and would be able to see where those employees could perhaps be better deployed. We no longer have the luxury of a job for life. We no longer have the luxury of going through education at one point in time and then not having to worry about our skill sets ever again. We're in a world where lifelong learning is becoming absolutely the thing that we all need to do. It's counterintuitive to many people, but actually, with the age of automation, with the way technology is developing, people are no longer going to have a single job and then retire at the age of 60. Employers need to get real about this. We need to adapt our society to support employees and employers to make the best of this. So from an employer standpoint, their needs are going to change over time. They're not going to be able to support one person in one role for 30 years in the same way, but they should know what the skills of their employees are. And I think part that perhaps is not given as much emphasis and as much weight by employers as perhaps it needs to, is that continuous professional development, is that continuous learning, is that assessment of whether the skills meet the job, meet the objectives of the organisation. It's too easy to keep jobs as they are, to keep the skill sets as they are, to keep the same people in the same role, and actually discover in a couple of years' time, you look back and you think, well, actually, we're not meeting our objectives. Why is that? Well, because we haven't moved with the times. So I think there's a real cultural change that's required in expectation not only of the employee, but also of the employer, that there is requirement on both sides to develop skills, to be constantly reassessing skills, and to be identifying the right fit.
We hear a lot from employers groups about how they can't find the right people, how the education system fails, how we've got 1,000 people who can push a broom, but they actually need somebody who can push a button. And this plays very much to what you're saying here. Can you just give me some top tips that you would start to say to employers, change their culture and change their approach?
Changing culture is hugely difficult, but it does need to start from the very top. So we need to ensure that boards, that chief execs, that senior executives understand the needs of their organisation and understand the realities of today's society. Those realities we've talked about, the fact that there is no longer a job for life, the fact that continuous professional development is essential, the fact that people and skills are going to shift over time and that that fit needs to be constantly reassessed. And once people start to understand that, it can become more systematized. It can become part of the way the organization works. It can become part of the HR structure. It can become part of the assessment structure. It can be part of the performance structure. I think a lot of what we've been talking about comes right back to organisations and individuals being open to the fact that the world around them is changing. The world of work is changing. And how does one adapt in order to put oneself in the best possible position to succeed?
Rachel, thank you for your time today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.